And okay, I think we're going. It's red, yeah? All right, so thanks so much. This is a great, such a nice invitation. So nice to be here. I just want to acknowledge my co-authors, Rebecca Ryan, who's an assistant professor at Georgetown University in the psychology department, and Michael Corey, who is a graduate student in sociology at Chicago and is working with me on these projects. As Marianne said, I have recently discovered the merits of time use data for thinking about investments in children and trying to think about how can we ask questions that are relevant to developmental psychology using time use data, you know, which is these data are not going to give us the kinds of deep measurement of parenting, and they aren't going to give us any measures of child outcomes. But I'm going to, you know, try to show you today how I think they can be used in a really interesting way to think about differences in the kinds of investments that parents make, and especially parents with different characteristics and social backgrounds. This is the motivation for this paper, which was actually a part of Sarah McClanahan's presidential address at the PAA meetings a couple years ago. Sort of apropos, that's the PAA meetings start tomorrow in San Francisco. As you may know, Sarah McClanahan is a sociologist, and what she was documenting here is what she observed, and of course many others have also observed, as this striking increase in inequality in many different dimensions across the kinds of investments that children were getting to promote their achievement and health and well-being. And in particular, she pointed to parental education as a sort of key driver of inequality, both in terms of parents' time and also in terms of the kind of economic or financial investments that kids were getting. And as she argued, you know, we're just seeing this bifurcation in the sense that more advantaged children with more advantaged parents were increasingly getting more of everything in terms of parents' time and money and all the other kinds of resources that those investments come with, whereas the children born to the least advantaged mothers were getting increasingly fewer of all those other of those same kinds of investments. So as I said, what I really want to focus on in this paper is parental time, and specifically the kind of parental time that's spent in active, interactive engagement with children, the kinds of time, in other words, that developmental psychologists think is the most fruitful and the most beneficial for children's development. So we're certainly not the first people to think of parental time as an important input into child development. In fact, I think this is actually one of the most interdisciplinary kinds of frameworks you could imagine, in the sense that many different fields have thought about parental time as a key resource. And I can just tell you briefly, you know, what I think economists and sociologists and what I know a little bit more of in terms of what developmental psychologists have to say about parental time as a resource. So, you know, the standard model in economics of household production views child development, the sort of production of child quality in economic terms, as this output of parental investment in both time and money. Parents invest time and money in their children because they derive utility from the child quality that it produces. I mean, this actually is, you know, very similar to the views that these other fields hold. So just slightly different terms, but really the same concept. In terms of actually studying parental time use, I would say that that's been largely the purview of sociology. So these big time use data sets have been developed by sociologists. People like Suzanne Bianchi, who's now at UCLA, are really the leading experts in looking at parental time. And sociologists view parents' time as the primary means by which parents socialize their children and pass on values and social norms and information and social capital to their children. And this is really, Jim Coleman really addressed this point originally in saying that the home environment and the specific ways that parents interact with their children in the home is really the root of inequalities that we see later in development. And developmental psychologists have long been interested in what we maybe more simply call parenting and the ways in which parents and children interact. And we've long regarded parents as key figures in the development of children, and have at a much more micro level study. I mean, that doesn't sound like, you know, sounds pretty straightforward, doesn't it? that parents would be important. And we have, you know, studied in great detail the kinds of parent-child interactions that the field believes promotes child well-being. And in particular has identified certain types of parenting that arguably reflect better kinds of time and higher quality time in the sense that they produce superior child development in different realms. So one of the key things that we know about parental time with children is that it varies regularly across different levels of parental education. And largely, the time use data has shown that it's the quantity of parental time that varies across levels of parental education. And going back, you know, many years, Frank Stafford and others, who are some of the original economists looking at time use data, have shown, and this is kind of a puzzle, that high SES mothers spend more time overall with children. And why I say that's a puzzle is because arguably their time would be more valuable outside the home. But they nevertheless show, you know, regularly higher levels of time spent with their children inside the home. And, you know, this kind of basic correlation has been replicated really in time use studies all around the world. And more recently, people like John Gurian, Frank Furstenberg, and others have shown that not only do parents with higher levels of education spend more time with children, they spend more time in quote-unquote enriching activities with their children. And so this falls along the lines of sort of teaching and educational kind of stimulation. Hillary. A phenomenon of being married.
Right, which we know is, has higher rates among more educated women.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, I should say I don't know, because these studies, I mean, obviously less educated women are going to be more overrepresented among unmarried women. So there's not, I don't know of a study offhand that has looked at what this so-called education gradient looks like. I mean, you could imagine it would be less steep,
right.
Because, you know, but it's not, I don't know. I mean, we are, you know, here we're just looking at the total effect. I mean, we're looking at I'll be showing you the kind of total population of married and single mothers together. So, a good question. Yeah. Kristen.
Could it possibly be curvilinear if you actually looked at high income, high education levels? Some of Luthar's work coming out on sort of the social
oh.
high income, where you were then not spending time with your children? Have people looked at that at the other end of the spectrum?
So that extremely. So we're looking at education.
Plus, very wealthy, that some of these things might go away.
Yeah. I don't know that either.
Mm-hmm. Would be interesting because she's finding a lot of risk factors with really high income families, as you find in poverty risks too.
So right.
To see what happens on that
right. Spectrum. I mean, I don't know. Are those risks she's talking about vis-a-vis parents' time with children, or
yeah?
She talks a little bit about that. Okay. Yep. Yeah, okay. And then, you know, just finally, one interesting thing is there's some new, a new paper by the Ramies, you may know of it, that has suggested that this quote-unquote education gradient in parental time has actually increased over time, which is sort of relevant to the general phenomenon I'm talking about. There's, you know, people debate whether this is true, and in fact, the time diary data we have at our disposal, in fact, are not totally ideal for looking at these secular changes in time. But if you, you know, their paper offers some provocative hypotheses, and theirs is largely that there has been this sort of increasing demand among the high educated for producing like super high quality kids to get them into super competitive colleges, and that that has driven ever increasingly these kind of you know, hysterical parent time investments in children. So, you know, and that's their argument. You know, and I should say also, this is just to let you know that I don't think anyone has a particular theory about whether there's some ideal amount of time to be invested in children. I mean, developmental psychology and no other field that I know of has sort of mapped out whether they're, you know, what's the actual relationship between number of minutes in some particular activity and some particular level of child outcome that we think arguably represents some distinct difference from some other level of that child outcome. So I'm going to be talking throughout about basically, you know, more or fewer minutes of time, but I'm not working towards any kind of final assessment about what, and no one else has either, about sort of what's the, you know, the ultimate package of parental time we should be striving for. Okay, so that, as I said, lays this the lay of the land for talking about what I said is called this education gradient in parental time. And as I said, I mean, it's really indisputable at this time that, that this correlation exists. But what we want to introduce here is this notion of what we're calling the developmental gradient in parental time, which argues, and I'll tell you why I think this is plausible in a moment, that maternal education shapes not only the amount of time that parents spend with their children, but possibly also its composition. And in other words, that highly educated mothers alter the composition of their time to respond to children's developmental needs. And by definition, children's developmental needs change as children grow older. And so what we're arguing here is that this education gradient that others have observed in the data can actually be characterized by a developmental gradient, and that more educated mothers will, the pattern of time use that more educated mothers will display will be characterized by this developmental gradient to a greater extent than their less educated counterparts. And I'm going to tell you a little bit more about what I mean by all of this, but you know, we will argue that this sort of developmentally sensitive kind of parenting time is another important element in the inequalities that we observe across groups of children. Okay, so again, trying to draw from a couple of different fields in terms of why should education relate not only to the levels of time investment, but to its composition. Here again, I think we can draw from economics, sociology, and again, developmental psychology. So, again, in very broad terms, in economics, education is arguably related to individuals' efficiency, so that choices in time use are made to maximize certain goals and certain outcomes. Bob Michael, Gary Becker, and others have argued that this kind of efficiency in non-market behavior can be observed in kind of home production. And so we argue that that could equally well be observed in terms of parents' time with children, which is a big component of home production. And one way of thinking about that, again, in very broad strokes, is to say that if you think about parental efficiency or parental effectiveness, you say parenting efficiency, people don't really like that, the way that sounds, so we can say kind of parental effectiveness. How might we observe that in time use data? We could observe it if we think that parents are minimizing the amount of time they spend on activities that are arguably less relevant for children of a particular age and maximizing their time on activities with children that are arguably more relevant. And here we're using children's age as sort of the benchmark for what is and isn't relevant, but you could think of other dimensions of children that could be equally plausible. And of course, there's lots of individual differences in children. So simply saying 3-year-olds need this and 10-year-olds need that is really broad, is super broad from a developmental psychologist perspective, because there's lots of individual differences. But that's the framework we're operating with in this paper. So we haven't found any paper in economics that has kind of looked at parenting behavior from this kind of efficiency perspective. But Annette Leroux in sociology has done a lot of qualitative work that kind of draws on these same themes. In her qualitative work, she finds that middle-class parents engage in a very different kind of parenting style than their working-class counterparts, in which essentially middle-class parents do this, what she calls concerted cultivation of children, spending the kinds of time with children and promoting their participation in activities that will be rewarded in the schools and arenas in which those children will eventually go on to inhabit, and in a very, as the term implies, a very concerted way, sort of a particular set of activities to promote what children, will eventually hope to accomplish. Whereas she reports that working class parents adopt what she called this accomplishment of natural growth strategy, where parents certainly attend to their children's emotional and physical needs, but otherwise sort of assume that children will develop just fine. As long as lots of, again, not to imply that all parents aren't focusing on the well-being of their children, but that for this one group of parents, there's no need for this elaborate strategy and plan. And she argues that this perpetuates this sort of inequality in the kinds of opportunities that children will go on to have, because certain of these characteristics that children will develop will go on, as I said, to be rewarded in school and in the labor market and so forth. And again, that's a kind of very small-scale qualitative study. Yeah, Anne?
Slightly random question, but
okay.
I've never worked here. And this point about some of the more, I think, ethnographic qualitative research on what parents are doing.
Yeah.
I've always wondered if one thing about more educated parents is that they spend their time use differently when they write down in a time diary.
Oh, yeah.
And so I wonder if we know anything about how time diary evidence lines up with the more sociological, observation-driven, with an outside observer characterizing the time. Do you think there's a gap there?
I think that the time use patterns that I will show you today will, line up with some of these qualitative observations, but the limitations of time diary data in terms of what parents say they do is, I think, very real. And I think the problem is, you're suggesting, is they can vary systematically across parents with different levels of education. So, parents actually rarely are doing only one thing, as it turns out, in the data. They're doing, and the kind of time that they spend with children in quote-unquote primary time minutes is very small relative to the amount of time they're spending in terms of kind of secondary time minutes. We don't actually know which one of those is better for child development, so let me say that. But I'm going to show you primary time minutes, and I'm going to argue that there's these differences, but it could very well be that parents with different characteristics differentially report what they're doing. I mean, if you're watching TV and talking to your child, or you're doing the dishes and talking to your child, which one of those is the thing you say you're doing? You can, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you about the data in a minute. One can, yeah. I mean, they ask which is the main thing you were doing, and then they say, were you doing anything else? So that's the kind of choice point where I think we have very little information on who reports what. But it's a good, so you should definitely bear that in mind. And then finally, as I said, thinking about the parenting literature from developmental psychology, really the hallmark of what we would call effective parenting is sensitive parenting. And, you know, what do we mean? I mean, we could say that sensitive parenting, to be a sensitive parent means that you respond contingently to your child's needs. And in principle, children's needs change as they go through different developmental periods. So that parents who kind of respond in these dimensions we observe in the time diary data to what we argue are the needs of children in broad strokes in those different developmental periods could be thought of as more developmentally sensitive than their counterparts who don't. And again, it's sort of a regular observable correlation in many different studies that high SES parents interact more sensitively with children on average, and this is across a variety of ways of defining sensitivity. All right. So, as I said, this will just be sort of a little detour into developmental psychology. I often give this talk to audiences where there are no other developmentalists in the room, so just spend 1 minute. And as I said, you know, children require different types of parental interactions in different periods of their development. And, you know, we distinguish in our data across four, you know, very broadly defined developmental periods. So in infancy, really the paramount concern of parenting is to provide basic care for children. So in the first year of life, really, you know, the central tasks are to help infants establish regular sleeping and eating routines and develop those initial capacities for self-regulation. And where does that come from? That comes from regular sensitive interactions from parents in feeding, bathing, soothing, physically caring for children, a whole suite of activities that, you know, we can just call basic care. And not only do those interactions attend to children's physical needs, but are also extremely important arenas for the development of social and emotional attachments to parents. So if their socio-emotional development comes out of these interactions very much as well. As children age, they obviously become capable of initiating and maintaining social interactions, having representational thoughts that allow them to engage in symbolic or pretend play. And this is a very important developmental skill for children in promoting their cognitive and social development. And parents, one of parents' major roles during this developmental stage is to help scaffold and engage and encourage children in those early kinds of activities. Which, as I say, will promote attention, vocabulary, numeracy and literacy, creativity, and really, I mean, the foundations of all the kinds of things we think of as school readiness and the kind of building blocks of learning that, you know, many of us study at later stages. So how do parents do this? We argue it's really through play. So playing games, creative activities like art projects, pretend play, these are the kinds of parent-child interactions that we argue facilitate these cognitive needs and capabilities at this stage of life. During the preschool period, as children advance in their cognitive and attention skills, they have an increasing appetite for sort of education-like activities in book reading, problem solving, doing puzzles and the like. And again, I mean, many people know that these kind of early skills are a critical element of what developmentalists and others call school readiness. We know in the data that there's already big gaps in school readiness by the time children across SES groups, by the time children even begin their formal schooling. And so we argue that, you know, what we could call teaching is a paramount parental activity during this stage of life. And we can observe this, again, in the time use data, but in other studies as well, with activities like reading with the child, simply talking and engaging in conversation. Homework is not really relevant for preschooler. You know, as I said, mainly these kind of school readiness activities. And then finally, in a developmental period that we're characterizing very broadly here, we're sort of leaving out, you know, there are developmentalists would take a more fine-grained approach to a period we're calling middle childhood, which spans from 6 to 13 years. We're really calling management the primary activity. So maybe everyone can relate to that. I mean, children increasingly have worlds that expand outside the home to peers and schools and extracurricular events. Parents need to monitor those social networks. Parents play a big role in helping to select their children's peers and the activities they participate in. And children, you know, begin to learn the tasks of forming relationships with others beyond their parents, learning self-control, adopting a sense of kind of personal efficacy in the choices that they make, and this kind of parental behavior in terms of really managing children's lives outside the home, we argue, you know, becomes relevant at this stage. Yeah, Marianne.
I guess I have a better sense of what you mean by what children require. So is this sort of what's thought of as needed for good emotional development or good?
Both, actually.
Like attachment theory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think this is a lot on the first 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Looking on that list would make me think of that attachment theory. Those are all sort of things you can do without a child attaching to you, right? Do you see what I'm saying? Is this about what you need to do to have a need to do? Is this sort of the formula for a child succeeding academically or emotionally?
No. I would say very much both. I mean, what I would say is that these are the key, that these different developmental periods, as I said, sort of require or demand different kinds of parental inputs, which are more, or and many of them are the same. I mean, basic care children need, you know, until they're teenage. I mean, until they leave the house and have to feed themselves. But that certain of these developmental or parenting tasks are more or less relevant at these different ages, because the kinds of interactions that go along with, you know, the kinds of interactions that parents and children engage in when they do these different activities is, responsive, sort of provides the avenue or the opportunity for parents to support their children's development in a variety of realms. I think there's nothing here that says that this is only about academic achievement or cognitive development. It's very much about these are the kinds of activities that will help to promote children's emotional and cognitive development. But it's really more that I think reading to the child, you know, in utero has been, you know, pretty much in the developmental, I mean, that's just sort of silly. I mean, there's no argument, you know, developmentally that says that that's sort of an effective use of time. But reading to the child, you know, in toddlerhood and preschoolhood is very much an effective use of time, because children have the capabilities to respond to those parental investments, and that their capabilities, their ability to respond changes as they get older.
Yeah. So I'm like outside the scope of this specific study.
Okay.
I was wondering what the theoretical activity would be after this middle childhood. Would it continue to be management once the kid's like an adolescent? Or does it shift to be
Yeah, no, that's a very good question. I mean, as you'll see from the data I'm going to show you, the level of parent primary time that parents actually spend with children diminishes greatly as children get older. And by the time they're in this 6 to 13-year-old group, it's actually a fairly minimal number of minutes. I mean, I could certainly argue that there's other kind of parenting time that would be relevant for 14 to 18-year-olds. Much of this, I also have to admit, is data-driven. Okay, so we have a limited set of things we can observe in the time use data. And, you know, we're trying to map it on as best we can to what we think is a kind of sensible theoretical framework. That sort of drove our, you know, we just don't have as fine-grained kinds of time use as we might hope to be able to say, anything more than beyond these sort of broad, and as I'm going to show you in a minute, we're actually going to collapse the sort of toddlerhood and preschool period. It's also a question of sample size. We don't have actually enough, you know, if we had a bazillion people, we could, you know, make much more fine-grained groupings because we would have a sufficient number of parents of children at much narrower age bands. Hovering? Yeah. Eavesdropping, yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. Okay. So let me just say, you know, again, like what kind of hypotheses we would then develop based on what I've told you so far. So if there were to be a quote-unquote developmental gradient, I mean, how would we know it when we see it? And the first is that we would argue that this developmental gradient could manifest in two different ways. The first is that highly educated parents would invest more time in an activity when it is developmentally important than at other stages of development. Okay, so given what I just told you is the sort of what's appropriate when, that we should see that highly educated parents, for example, would invest more time in basic care during children's infancy than they would during the children's preschool or middle childhood period, okay? Which is, again, not to say that basic care isn't important at other stages, but that given our theories that this is the paramount concern of parents of infants, that's when we should see the emphasis on basic care. The other way that we could see this developmental gradient is that highly educated parents should tailor their child-rearing time to their children's developmental needs to a greater degree than their less educated counterparts. So in other words, just because highly educated parents sort of concertedly cultivate or efficiently allocate their time across different developmental stages doesn't mean that their less educated peers wouldn't do the same thing. But if this developmental gradient exists, then we should find, you know, gaps in the developmental gradient across parents' education groups. So highly educated parents could invest more time in basic care in infancy relative to the time they spend on basic care with children of older ages. But during infancy, if we then look within the period of infancy, we should see highly educated parents doing more of that activity relative to their less educated peers. And similarly for these other kind of activities for children at different developmental stages. We should see that the gap between highly educated parents and less educated parents should change over time, in other words, for children of different ages. And I'll just give you a preview. That's what we find. And if we, you know, having, and as I will show you that, then we will conclude that this education gradient that has been observed in the data historically is actually characterized by what we're calling this developmental gradient in turn. All right? Okay, so let's get to the seminar goes till 1:30. Okay, we have plenty of time. And interrupt all you want. So we're using data from the American Time Use Survey, which is an ongoing national survey conducted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The data are actually available now up to 2010. So this is these are just cross-sectional data sets conducted every year. We're pooling together the data from 2003 to 2007, which reflects when we started this paper. The way the data are collected is that telephone interviews ask a randomly selected person age 15 or older to recount how he or she spent the previous day. The sample covers all days of the week and all months of the year. It collects, and you can account for the fact for whether the time diary was a weekday or a weekend interview. The data distinguishes primary from secondary activities, but actually the level of detail on the secondary activity is not as great as the level of detail on the primary activity, so we restrict our focus here just to primary activities with children. And also because we think by definition a primary activity requires the parent to be actively engaged in an interaction with the child. And I should say, as I said before, that it's not clear from research whether that is more beneficial to children's development than is sort of just being there and interacting, being around for the child in a secondary kind of activity. We're starting, you know, we're starting here with the primary activity because we can say what it is more specifically with these data. There's also high quality demographic information. So the ATUS is fielded in conjunction with the current population survey. So those data sets are linked. So you have all the high quality demographic information that's available in the CPS. We're going to control for just a handful of kind of exogenous covariates in our regressions. But the data, you know, by virtue of its size and knowing what everybody did over a 24-hour period, we think really offers a very rich opportunity to answer these kinds of questions. Okay, so we're just looking at mothers here, but one could easily do this same paper with fathers, and we actually have done that. We're working on that now, and I can just tell you now we see the same pattern of results, but much weaker when we look at whether there's a developmental gradient for fathers. So we restrict our sample here to women who have at least one child age 13 or younger in the home. We are only looking at time on the weekend here because we think that given the number of mothers who work, that weekend days sort of offer the greatest number of possible minutes to interact with your child. I should say when we combine weekdays and weekends, we see the same pattern of results. And then we exclude households who have stepchildren because there's a number of theories about why parental investments in stepchildren would differ in systematic ways than parental investments in own biological children, and so we exclude those small number of children. And so we have then about 6,640 mothers here, whom we divide into these four levels of education, as you can see here. And what we do is not only do we look at mothers with these different levels of education, but we then group children into these different age groups. Now, here is an important problem with the data is that when mothers report who they're interacting with in a parenting activity, you don't actually know which child the parent is interacting with. So this is, you know, from a developmentalist perspective, this is a big problem. You know, we know that parents are doing these activities, as I said, but not with whom they are engaged. So what we do is we use the youngest age of the child in the household as our sort of our grouping variable. So mothers with children ages zero, with at least one child in the zero to, whose youngest child is in the zero to two or any of the other two groups in the household is grouped into that group with the argument that at least there's a child in the relevant age range for whom mothers might be interacting. But, you know, mothers may be saying they're doing basic care, and it could be that they're doing basic care for their teenager, and we don't actually know that. So, you know, this is a formula that Eric Hurst followed in a previous paper And as I say, we follow it here. What we have done is we've tested the sensitivity of these results to one-child families, in which case we know that that's the... And the sample is much smaller, and we're, you know, the basic pattern of results is the same, but, you know, we didn't think that that bigger restriction made sense for talking about these kind of population-level trends. And then, as I say, given sample size, you know, I told you there was something special about, you know, the first year of life, the first 12 months. It turns out we can't really even look at that first year separately given our limited number of cases. So we have these three age groups here, you know, 0 to 2, 3 to 5, and 6 to 13. Yeah.
It is good to know that I think that your results hold for looking at all days because we know
yeah.
that young, less educated...
are more likely to work weekends. That's exactly right. That has come up before. That's exactly right. So we could be, you know, privileging, you know, the highly educated mothers who don't have to work on a Saturday or a Sunday. That's exactly right. And so that's, you know, we wanted to make sure that they held. Yeah, and so... That's right. That's right. And, you know, we're not looking at any mechanisms or pathways here. So we're not going to control for income or maternal employment or any of that. But that's an excellent point, and we have thought of that.
As I said that out loud, I started to think about, would there be any value in, as another way of measuring the input, what if you did something like, I was just thinking about the Mama Saturday thing.
Mm-hmm.
If I... looked at the time she spent with her child as a share of her discretionary time.
Yeah.
That might yield something. I mean, I'm not
right.
sure.
It's a different.
Is at the right time, but it is kind of an interesting.
It is. Exactly. We have thought of that, and we have, you know, we started out looking at shares
right.
of time here instead of levels,
right.
and we just
shares after taking out something.
Exactly, and it just it gets complicated,
right.
But it's an equally valid way to look at this. As I say, we're just sort of comparing these mean number of minutes, but right, you know, of the number of hours you're not working,
right.
how do you allocate that? Right. I mean, the concept is, yeah, I totally agree. Preferences or views of parenting or something, then maybe, you know, shares is, right. Right. Yeah, Ross. Okay. Say it again. Yeah, no. Right. Right. Because somebody else might be. No, I totally agree, and I'm very interested in that kind of question. For that, what you need is a time diary from the child's perspective, which exists. So you have the PSID Child Development Supplement, which we were talking about this morning, has a time diary attached to it. And there you can look at all the inputs that the child is receiving from anyone who's interacting with the child. And you can very much see who's doing what, how that package of investments differs across different groups, but here it's the time diary of the adult. So, right, you should absolutely not take this as any sign of what children are getting, but rather it's what parents are doing. And that, you know, brings me to the next slide, because when I show this slide, people are always really shocked at how few minutes parents are engaged in, quote unquote, you know, what I'm calling parenting as a primary activity. Okay? So the total number, this is now just pooling everybody together, those 6,600 people, respondents in my study, just taking all those kids across all ages and showing you, you know, the number of minutes that these mothers are engaged in primary activity that involves one of those activities that I told you about. And you can also see an example in the middle column of the kind of time use codes that we're using to kind of count parents as doing one of these four basic genres of parenting. And it, you know, it's certainly debatable that we could have coded this differently. We actually, again, followed John Gurian and Eric Hurst. They have a really nice paper with Melissa Kearney in the Journal of Economic Perspectives that just shows this education gradient, and we actually used their code. And you know, the ATUS doesn't get a lot more detailed than this, so there aren't many more choices for recoding. So you can just see for yourself what kinds of time activities fall into basic care, play, teaching, and management. And you can see, and again, these are weekend days, but the numbers that mothers are engaged in these kind of activities are higher on weekends than weekdays. And you can see that mothers spend the most time in basic care and then in decreasing order play and teaching and management.
When they ask for the time use, so it's the day before that they're reporting, mm-hmm. on an hour by hour, a half hour by half hour basis?
It's 15-minute increment, actually. No, it's every 50. You go through a calendar of the blocks of time and say, what were you doing in each of these? Well, sleep, you know, it's a week. I mean, sleep is 8 hours of the day. I mean, the household management, any other thing. And I should say there's also a much larger number of minutes spent with children as a secondary activity. So this is the minute that you said, you know, you were sitting down and reading a book, and that was your primary activity. Not that you weren't, you know, cooking dinner, but having a really important conversation with your child at the same time.
Okay.
Well, I mean, again, a homework is not the best example of the codes. I think more relevant is that we have, you know, reading to and talking to as an example of a teaching kind of thing. Over here?
So I wanted to talk a little bit more about the secondary activity.
Mm-hmm.
Your choice to focus on the primary. But you mentioned you've done some probing on other analyses with fathers.
With fathers, yeah. We've looked at
fathers. Have you done any probing of the secondary?
We haven't yet done that. There's the codes for secondary activities are much, much broader. So we can't look at all of these codes as secondary activities the way we can look at them as primary activities. If we could, I would have just, you know, looked at them separately or combined the two or something. But the data limitations present a problem to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and the child might be there. Right. At mealtime is actually the. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, no. I agree. And we haven't gotten into them yet. But I definitely agree with you. And as I say, you know, we have very few data sets, I'll just say this, that sort of allow us to look in the quantitative fashion at the correlation between parents' time use and children's outcomes. And we have lots and lots of studies of parenting that show different ways that, different sort of how, you know, parenting is related to child outcomes. But in terms of time diary data, really the PSID Child Development Supplement is the only U.S. data set that allows us to do that because it has this child time diary and it has a wealth of child outcomes. But I think that's why we don't know fully the relevance of primary time versus secondary time, you know, vis-a-vis what's going to promote child development. Yeah. Yeah. I wish I could tell you. I cannot remember. They're lower.
Yeah.
For sure.
Given how low these were in some sense, I was just curious if they were not as different as I would have thought they were.
Right. No, they're actually even lower. And I should say the other thing is there's a ton of zeros in these data. So there's a, we account for that, but there's a lot of mothers who on the diary day don't engage in any one of these things at all. That's another just limitation of who knows. Maybe they were sick and they were in bed all day. I mean, this is just a random draw of one day. As I said, what we've done, we didn't look separately at weekdays, but we looked at weekend and weekdays combined, and the pattern of results is qualitatively similar. Given the other demands on parents' time during the week.
Mm-hmm. So how you would really measure that, the totals would be so much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Some sort of normalizing maybe by minutes per day, so you're measuring gaps in terms of percentages.
Yeah, I think this is getting back to the share question, I think, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. As I say, I mean, we sort of approach this as giving, what we thought of giving everybody the greatest opportunity to, devote time in these ways. Hillary's point is a really good one, that's not necessarily the case. But, I mean, you could imagine it's even more interesting when there's even more time constraints and there's, less time to allocate. It could be. It's possible. I mean, we're not going to control for maternal employment. Which is, as I say, why we look, made sure that the pattern was essentially the same across both types of days. Okay, so just to look at the sample characteristics, these are the covariates that we're going to include in our regression models. And we have mother's age on the interview day, mother's race and ethnic background, and we do control for the number of children in the house, and you could argue that that's endogenous to mother's education. Given this possible correlation between family size and the age of the youngest child in the household, we thought that not including number of children at home would sort of confound these patterns that we're trying to look at. And then we have an ATUS weight from the 2006 survey. So as I said, almost as descriptive as you can get with these kind of data. We're going to do a very simple regression strategy using Tobit models that include this handful of exogenous covariates and then an interaction term between that, child age group and those mothers' education levels, where high school educated mothers are the reference category for maternal education. And the child age reference category for each of the different activities is the age at which I argued was the most developmentally appropriate. So that's going to vary. And then I'm going to just show you five figures going forward, which essentially are just going to show you predicted probabilities. And I think you'll see the pattern very clearly. Did you have a question, Ross? No? Okay. So before I get into the specifics, what I'm going to show you here are just the unadjusted weighted differences in mother's time by education. So this is really showing you what Gurian and colleagues have shown. This is just the education gradient. So the letters here represent significant mean differences between education groups for that activity. So this is all children combined, all 6,600 of those children. And here we're just looking across those four different types of activities that we're interested in: basic care, play, teaching, and management, with the different colored bars representing mothers with different levels of education. So really two things that you can take away from this slide is, first, that mothers spend most of their time in basic care, and you saw that in the slide that I just showed you. And second, that the largest gaps in time use are really between mothers with a college education and all other mothers, okay, with many fewer differences between the mothers with other levels of education. So, you know, this really corresponds to what many people are saying is sort of pointing to college education as the important distinction when we're thinking about inequality and parental investments. All right, so I'm going to I'm going to skip this because it's easier to see it in the figure. So let me explain how to look at these figures. I'm going to show you five figures. The first is going to look at all parenting time together, sort of the basic care, the play, the teaching, and the management. And then we're going to go through four slides that will look at each of those kinds of time separately. And pooling all types of child care together, you see that the education gradient in child care time is really only apparent when children are at the youngest ages. So what you want to focus on is the gap between the blue dotted line and the black solid line, which is the gap in parental time across all kinds of primary time with children for parents who have children at these different ages. So this gap in time when children are 0 to 2, so the one on the far left side of the figure, that difference is significantly different from the same difference when children are ages 3 to 5, and is also that gap is significantly larger than the gap we observe when children are ages 6 to 13. And moreover, there's no significant difference in the gap between these latter two groups. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? So what we see is that if we just looked at all this, you know, these 86 minutes that mothers are spending on primary child time on a weekend day, the highly educated mothers are pulling away from their less educated peers during the earliest years of their children's life. You know, maybe because of this sort of focus on early childhood as being the key developmental stage. You know, Eric Hurst, in another recent paper, has also argued that there is a sort of early childhood educational gradient that seems to be increasing over time. You know, again, perhaps due to this, you know, maybe everybody has read Jim Heckman or something and is, you know, really focused, especially highly educated mothers, on the sort of earliest stages of children's life. So, you know, if I just stopped here, this would tell you a little bit more than what Gurian and Hurst have already told us, which is to tell you at what childhood stage this education gradient is really happening at. But I'm going to go through these and hopefully tell you a little more by going now through four slides that show the four different kinds of activities and seeing what that developmental gradient looks like. Okay, so this slide looks a lot like the previous slide, where we see that the education gradient in basic care is only apparent when children are ages 0 to 2, and that essentially the lines are parallel and there's no significant difference in the gap between children who are 3 to 5 or 6 to 13, you know, which tells us what I said vis-a-vis the last slide, that the highly educated mothers are pulling away from their less educated peers in basic care during the earliest years of their child's life. And you'll recall that I made an argument to you at the outset that basic care for youngest kids was the developmental activity that a developmentally effective parent would be focusing on. Okay? When we look at playing, we see that the education gradient in playtime is also only apparent when children are ages 0 to 2. That doesn't quite line up with the developmental theory I gave you, which I said was going to be after the first year, that was going to be sort of ages 2 to 3. But I told you that our data limitations didn't allow us to distinguish the children in their first year of life from their older counterparts. But the education gap for mothers of children at ages 0 to 2 in play differs significantly from the same gap we see at age 3 to 5 and at 6 to 13. And again, these two gaps don't differ from one another. So again, highly educated mothers are really investing in playtime when their children are in those earliest years of life to a greater extent than their better educated peers, and to a greater extent than their counterparts with children of different ages. Here's the results for teaching, which show you here that the education gradient in teaching time is such that the gap between college-educated mothers and their high school-educated counterparts is the greatest when children are in the 3 to 5 age range. Which, again, we argued that was a developmental period of particular relevance for these kinds of parenting investments. That's what we see. We see that highly educated mothers are emphasizing teaching when it matters most. And finally, the results for management. So here we find, again, this education gradient in management time such that the gap is largest between those college-educated mothers and their high school-educated counterparts when children are in the 6 to 13 age range. So again, they seem to be emphasizing management at the developmental stage that we argued it was most important. Okay, so as I said, that's descriptive. That's what it is. Those are the results. And you could ask, given how few minutes we're actually talking about here, is this meaningful at all? We think that added up over, if a weekend day, and we could argue that it's not representative of a weekday for a variety of reasons, but if you just said this is one day that's representative of a lot of days, if we take mother's time in basic care as an example, this sort of education basic care gap for infants and toddlers is 30 minutes per weekend day. Over this period, over this developmental stage, this would lead to the idea that college-educated mothers spend roughly 183 more hours responding to infants' basic physical and emotional needs during the child's first year of life. Again, that would argue that this day is like every other day, but looked at over the course of the year. And if you think that infants are only awake 12 hours a day to receive these kinds of inputs, that begins to look like a meaningful difference. Similarly, thinking about time in play for infants and toddlers, again, that gap is about 30 minutes a day. And if you think about that amount of time spread out over the 2 years that children spend between their first and third birthdays, that's 365 more hours, which is equivalent to 6 months in a half-day preschool. And we can, again, we can do this exercise for all these different kinds. I mean, this makes a lot of assumptions about how representative one day is of all the other days, about how many hours these children are available to get those inputs and so forth, and it pays no attention at all to individual differences. But, you know, we think that despite the small number of minutes that we're observing here on the day that we're measuring the time, that, you know, these could add up to meaningful differences over time. Okay, so surely lots of limitations in this these kinds of analyses. So, as Anne was saying, the childcare time is self-reported. It's possibly biased in unknown directions. I mean, the time use world, researchers in the time use world argue that time diary data are much more reliable than the kind of stylized survey questions that ask parents, tell me how much you did X, Y, or Z on the following day. But that certainly, you know, doesn't alleviate concerns that that there's, you know, self-reporting bias that differs in unknown ways across different kinds of people, especially this question of is this a primary or a secondary activity. And then, as I said before, you know, I certainly can't make any predictions about what is the ideal amount of time that parents ought to be spending with their children, because there's so many individual differences that are relevant here in ways that this, you know, survey can't capture. And, you know, we don't benchmark this kind of time anyway vis-a-vis child outcomes. Nevertheless, I think we have shown that maternal education shapes not just the amount of time that mothers spend with their kids, but also the composition of that time. And we have argued here that highly educated mothers appear to be more developmentally effective in their time with their children by tailoring their time across children's developing stages and needs. We don't know where this comes from. And so, you know, the policy implications are not clear at all. You know, the mechanisms could be demographic correlates of education, like maternal work status and schedules, marital status, income. You know, we don't want to control for any of those endogenous variables in these regressions. So we don't. And so, you know, we can't say anything about what the mechanisms are. You know, but what else could education reflect? It could reflect differences in preference for or beliefs about investment and its later life returns for children, knowledge about parenting. Interesting discussion by Betsy Stevenson about how parents at different with different economic or educational backgrounds view childcare as a consumption activity versus an investment activity. And she argues that for highly educated parents, childcare is a consumption activity in a way that it's not for less educated parents. You know, all these things we certainly can't measure in the time diary data. And, you know, that leads us, as I say, I certainly don't want to overstate any kind of policy implications, because these are just purely descriptive correlations I'm showing you. But nevertheless, it is true that the idea of parenting knowledge or the relevance of parenting behavior or parenting values, that those things drive parenting differences and that those are related in different, in sort of regular ways to social class, this really underscores a lot of different interventions we have in developmental psychology and elsewhere. So, I mean, everyone has probably heard of the Harlem Children's Zone, and who, you know, the major thrust is to, as Jeffrey Canada himself has said, is to get less educated parents to behave more like middle class parents and engage with their kids in a different set of ways. So if we thought that, you know, that this was just about parenting knowledge, you know, then that would be the strategy we would want to pursue for intervention. If we thought this was, you know, really something about parental education, a set of skills or qualities that come with education, you know, then we would have a different approach to intervention. But really, without knowing the ways in which education and parenting behavior are causally linked, as I say, I think the implications for policy are quite unclear. But I think we can nevertheless say that the notion that this time gap could have long-term implications for children's achievement and attainment is something that we can take away from these data, and gives us another perspective on this this notion of diverging destinies. All right, so that's all I have. I'll welcome more questions.
Some of the questions that came up today, if you've got follow-up planned in terms of trying to understand mechanisms, or we talked about the sort of about Paul's comment and Anne's comment put together about the secondary activity and the lack of the differences in reporting would be really interesting to pursue in its own. I can totally imagine.
Yeah.
Of course, I was, you know, walking to the grocery store and there were other people. I thought I probably would report that differently than, not necessarily by class, but I would really report the same activity, but how, I don't know, frustrating your kid is going to affect how you think about those things, too, among other. I mean, there's many, many reasons people would report these things differently, and if you put secondary and total and added them up.
Yeah. Well, there's much more that we want to try to do, you know, with the secondary. As I said, I mean, this is our, you know, our first foray into these data, and that's why we started with the primary. But I think this is critically important to look at the secondary. And this, you know, this is possible whether we can totally line it up. You know, we might not have as, I know we won't have as good a level of detail. So whether we can answer the same question incorporating the secondary data, I'm not optimistic about, but there's lots of other. The question about bias, I guess I would have to think more about how the data would allow us to look at that.
What I'm thinking is if you see that low-educated mothers report the same total time, primary and secondary, in a particular activity as the more educated. That one group is reporting, you know, is primary, and the other one is secondary.
I agree. It would. And so the question is, again, because the level of detail on the secondary activity is not as great, whether I can line that up exactly, I'm not sure. You see what I mean? Sorry?
How detailed is the secondary?
It's at a level of coding that is sort of one level up from this. So that doesn't... it's not clear that it's going to allow me to break up the data into these different kind of categories, the sort of developmentally relevant categories. So, but, I mean, in principle, it's a good question that, you know, I mean, for somebody interested in the methodology of time use in this, it's a... You know, people don't use secondary time... very much at all. I mean, so if you look at Suzanne Bianchi's papers, you know, which are all about sort of predicting different kinds of time, not just parenting time, it's all about primary time. And I think, you know, the level of the measurement is a big part of that. There was another question you asked me. Yeah, the mechanisms. So how would you look at the mechanisms?
I think it would just be interesting to do exactly the same analysis by income.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't necessarily tell you whether tell you how much of the income
is about income,
but,
right.
And I guess I have been thinking on and off all year about Sean Reardon and stuff
about income. Yep.
The achievement gap. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had said that before. Mm-hmm.
Income, education, and marital status simultaneously, which one of how is each of those accounting for different portions?
Yeah. We have been, yeah, I mean, I think, and stratifying on these, you know, just other variables to see how similar or different the patterns look. Right.
I mean, I understand that if you just stick into the regression, you're kind of always going to
be... Yeah, you know, right, you know, right.
You could learn something about what might be going on by just doing essentially this analysis.
Yeah, with a different stratifying variable.
Mm-hmm. It's also the case that all these regressions that are looking at the effects of
mm-hmm.
A lot. And I've always found that to be a really interesting result, even though I realize there's problems with that pattern shows up over and over again.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah, let me show you, I think this slide, which I didn't present, does this give you the information that you would want to answer that question? So...
curious patterns in the education gradient for management reverses from youngest age level to oldest age level.
Yeah, I mean, but the difference is much smaller.
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's which is why we don't, you know, the regression is going to show you that yeah, exactly. But, so is this a problem?
No, not as much as I was thinking.
Oh, good. Yeah. Right. Right. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. Just on a day when mothers aren't working.
Day of work versus not work. Because I actually would assume that lower educated or lower SES moms might be more likely to have to work on a weekend.
Yeah, that's what Hillary was saying. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Not the traditional 9-to-5 mm-hmm. Friday. So
that's right. I mean, we could be sort of, you know, disadvantaging the less educated mothers if they are working on one of our weekend days. I think we can do that. I mean, because we should be able to do that. We know if they're working on the survey day.
And then weird random question about the methodology of actually calling these families.
Oh, calling them.
Does it include mobile phones as well as landlines?
Yeah, no, I don't think that would be the case because all these surveys are relying on mobile numbers. I mean,
CPS is actually in a survey of housing units, mm-hmm.
rather than
a random sample of phone numbers.
Right.
Because I know a lot of people are now shifting away from having landlines at all.
Yeah.
They're only calling landlines.
Right.
Yeah, no, I mean, the survey.
Political survey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not going to bias these. Mm-hmm.
long talks to
What I would say is developmental psychology has a theory that it's the quality of the interaction that matters, not the frequency or the duration. And that's what we're really missing from these data, you know, which makes this not really a legitimate developmental psychology paper. And developmentalists have, you know, expertise in measuring the quality of interactions, but in ways that are, you know, prohibitively expensive, that we can't get this kind of sample size. That's a connection we can't make with these kind of data. Right, and as I say, you know, we don't know anything. I mean, changing a diaper can involve singing and interacting, or it cannot. And so, you know, we're just measuring. Right, I mean, we're just really, you know, this is a very crude assessment of, you know, and I wouldn't call it parenting quality. And I'm willing to. Oh, we didn't look at that. Actually, I mean, we're controlling for mother's age, but we didn't look separately at mother's age.
I know you're a little hesitant to use the secondary activity.
Yeah.
But I'm sort of thinking about how this might have changed in the last 2007, 2005, to become more prevalent. You can always be doing secondary activity.
Yeah, even during a seminar, you can. Right. That's a good thing. And actually, I've done that with a different paper, not with these data. But actually, it was about the frequency of eating meals together. And it turns out that eating meals together when you're are or aren't watching TV is totally differentially related to, in this case, we were actually looking at the likelihood of divorce. And mealtime is actually, if you look in the time use data, it's mealtime together as a couple is a huge predictor of divorce in a subsequent year. This is totally not about this paper anymore. No, spending more, yeah. No, but eating meals together, there's a lot of sociological work on mealtimes and this as a site for, you know, family interaction. But it turns out, so, exactly, eating mealtimes and not watching TV. Right. So, I mean, but that just gives us, yeah, I don't know, checking email while you're eating dinner. But that gives us some insight into how we could think about assigning some notion of quality to measures like this. If you think that this is something where you can devote your full attention to it or not. But, yeah.
Yeah, one thing I was thinking of, too, in terms of, teaching time or the activities of teaching, if there is a secondary activity of watching TV or having TV on in the background, because there has been increasing work showing that having TV on in the background is very disruptive for young children's learning, because even if they're engaging with a toy, a noise will happen on the TV and they'll orient to it and then they have to re-engage with the toy. And it, even if parents aren't even aware that the child is being disrupted by the TV in the background, that it is kind of detrimental or affects their learning. So that's
So that's, again, that's a nice, with the PSID child development supplement, if you were going to look at those time diary data and you were interested in looking at correlations between time children, you could do something like that. Yeah.
I'm going to stop the questions at the point to turn it over. We have coffee and cookies and juice out, so folks who would like to stay and